Hello, I'm Karen O'Connor, a consultant speech and language therapist, and this is the Karen O'Connor podcast, part of openingyourmind.com. Openingyourmind.com is my website where I share my extensive knowledge and unique pieces of the jigsaw approach so that your child can achieve their greatest potential over the shortest period of time. We blend up-to-the-minute speech and language therapy techniques with sensory integrative techniques, including sound therapy, which will be impacting on the neuroplasticity of the brain, so that your child can achieve their greatest potential quickly and easily. If you enjoy the podcast, please remember to subscribe to ensure that you don't miss future podcast episodes. And if you have a moment, please rate and review this podcast. The more ratings and reviews we get, the more people this podcast will reach, as iTunes and other podcast apps start to recommend it to people like you. Thank you so much. Looking forward to talking to you. And I'm delighted to be here this morning to talk to Mary Slevin. She's a clinical psychologist from the National Maternity Hospital in Holles Street in Dublin. And we over the last couple of years, did a lovely collaboration piece of research, an internationally recognized, randomized control study. As I say, a collaboration between the NMH, the National Maternity Hospital in Dublin, and also the Child Development Centre here in Galway. The title of our study, our research study, which was only very recently published in the Irish Medical Journal in January 2020, was called Therapeutic Listening for Preterm Infants with Sensory Dysregulation, Attention and Cognitive Problems. So I'm delighted to be here this morning to talk to Mary so that we can just talk through everything in terms of the background to the study, how we decided on doing the study, who we did the study with, what the results were, and what that means for families of preterm infants all over the world. So Mary, lovely to be here with you this morning.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here with you.
Thank you for coming. It's amazing. I know over the last number of years we've been working away on the study, on the research. So it's kind of funny now when we're at this end of it, when we've had it published in the Irish Medical Journal and all that. But it's nice to have an opportunity to go back and say, right, why did we do it initially? What is the background to the study?
I remember, you know, I have a lot of experience assessing preterm children and just observing them over the years and really struggling to know where to go next or where to turn next for the child that would come into me, would be really, really busy, running all over the place, practically climbing the walls, with very poor contact and engagement with me when I'd even be testing the child, calling by name and not responding. And then parents would comment in the background, well, actually, it's the same at home. And the children just not, you know, in a sense, they didn't seem calm, or we would describe regulated. Mm-hmm. They were unable to ease themselves into the environment that they were coming into. Mm-hmm. Now, these children, you know, would be, when I started assessing them, they would be unable to sit still for very long. They'd be constantly wriggling to get away and to go down onto the floor to play. Sometimes we'd have to remove the toys from the assessment room. And that in itself is very telling, because the children who are able to engage with the test materials that I'm using for the Bailey assessment should be able to block or inhibit their attention from attending to those test materials. But it's like the children want everything you have, and each time they take something up, they're not satisfied. So they're searching and searching. And I feel sorry for them, because they become very frustrated, and some will do their best to comply, and then they will start a task and invariably the materials will be sort of cast to the floor, flung across the room in frustration. Mm-hmm. And then even to try and do any of the language skills is absolutely impossible. And kind of pulling the book and wanting to turn pages and unable to regulate, settle and respond. And you know there's a big difference, because there are children who will come in and do a Bailey assessment with me. They're able to sit, They attend, they're searching to see what's coming next. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. enjoying the assessment, they're calm, they're regulated. They even start to praise themselves when they perform very well. So you can see there's a big, big difference. And yeah. even, you know, the children in that sense with this poor ability to adapt to the environment, they become quite tense and they're mm-hmm. bursting a little bit mm-hmm. too. And they're... Mm-hmm. They're trying, and they sometimes I have to explain to parents not being bold, and parents are disappointed sometimes when the child isn't, you know, performing. Mm-hmm. And I would say, look, this is beyond the child's capabilities right now. They're not doing this on purpose, and mm-hmm. and so yeah, and then realizing that these children have potential. So I would have children coming in for assessment that would be genuinely showing inability to perform, but these are children that have the potential, and what was happening is they weren't able to tap into it. Yeah. And as a result of that, they're coming out with, you know, concerning or you know, low Bayley scores, and you're just knowing in your heart and soul that that's not entirely representative of that child's level of ability. Brilliant. And that I can stand over very confidently yes. and say that, you know, and yeah. the more I do it, the more I feel I know exactly, mm-hmm. you know, what's
and
happening.
And that was a big push for us, yeah. really, wasn't it? Because you were seeing this group of children who were very busy, as we say, dysregulated, and I think that's something we should probably define, yes. is that whole sensory regulation piece. It's the nervous system's ability to, I suppose, regulate, process that sensory stimuli and general environmental stimuli, as well as stimuli coming through the body in a regulated, calm fashion, so that, as you say, that they can focus and attend yeah. on the task at hand. So you were seeing all this great potential, but it was difficult to measure it, really, wasn't it, in terms of formal assessment?
You couldn't, and you would... you know, you create an environment that is going to support that child as well. You try to have everything calm and parents saying nothing. And even when I would be going to assessment feedback, I'd often say to parents that when they're doing things at home to break things down into little bits, mm-hmm. ask them about the environment that they're engaging their child in. But mm-hmm. parents will always support, this is what he's like at home. I have mm-hmm. tried doing this with him. He's not responding in attention, they're not responding to story time, it's wanting to grab the book and turn, and then the children making very loud noises often, mm-hmm. Just using their own voices in one way to try and regulate themselves. Yeah, and yeah. even watching some of them yeah. hum a little bit
yes.
and sing a song.
Yeah.
And then they invariably are unable to communicate very well because they don't have the language to communicate. And
that's
so
right.
You know, I would often play a little soundtrack that would have a variety of sort of everyday sounds and some animal sounds. And then you watch the child to show any recognition of anything, and there's just no response. Mm-hmm. So that's mm-hmm. the type of child. Mm-hmm. So I was so delighted when we ended up communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think it's over a number of years. And, mm-hmm. and it was around the time you published your first book. And having read the case histories in that book, it really gave me fantastic insight to the type of things that were happening with other children. I could see where my preterm mm-hmm. Little mm-hmm. children were fitting into, yeah. and then how effective the therapeutic listening was with these children. And as we know, this is not a quick fix.
No.
This is time.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So I think I used to bounce off you for help and knowing how to manage or what would we do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then that's how we started this relationship mm-hmm. of kind of, we decided one day, I suppose, when I'm referring to you, then we need to maybe have a look and see, how is this an effective treatment?
Exactly. Because all the time, as you were seeing those kids, I was seeing a whole other group of kids in clinic, mm-hmm. some born preterm, some not. And we were using things like sound therapy, therapeutic listening, the LIFT program, things yeah. like that. So that's really when we said, let's look at, you know, doing a study to see with preterm infants.
The reason as well is we have our early intervention services and we have our primary yeah. care services, but sometimes those services are so overwhelmed with the needs of children that are greater mm-hmm. sometimes than a mm-hmm. child with poor attention and self-regulation.
Yes.
And yet they're really important because the long-term research for preterm infants is showing that they have problems with their working memory and their executive functioning mm-hmm. skills. And these are two things that crop up when they're older in the classroom. And this is what I explain to parents. while it's very, it's so important to address these issues now so that they are prepared and able to cope with the demands of school
later on, and that they're reaching their potential. Yeah. So the beauty of this is we were looking at using or researching a technique that was non-invasive, therapeutic listening,
and that we could be done at home, but the only problem here is that the children that can only avail of this are children that can go privately at the moment, the children have to present with more significant, maybe fine motor or significant gross motor difficulties before the early intervention service can work with them. But I think this is an area that we can kind of explore further.
Absolutely.
I think by doing the research, we're able to bring this piece of information to the early intervention teams, primary care centres, and just say, look, this is something you can look at for all children.
Absolutely.
And it means less professional time in the clinic. It's much more cost effective.
Yes.
It's a home programme, and we've proven actually that this can be done with very, very successfully. So then that's, I suppose,
we went fantastic. So let's take a little look then and get the detail out there. So who exactly did we do the study with? If we were to break it down, we had
ISS children that are born less than 1500 grams and or 29 weeks gestation, and I have my annual list every year. So within that list, we started small because the study is intensive in terms of the treatment. We ended up with 20 children that we embarked on for the study. And of those 20, we had to divide them up into an intervention group, which was our therapeutic listening group,
then
our control group.
Yeah.
So it was a randomized controlled trial, as you said earlier, and that's a really important factor about this research. It's properly randomized and controlled, and it's a registered trial.
Yeah.
And that makes the information very strong. And also, I suppose, given the small number size, it's we would deem this as a pilot study, something to be looked at further down the road and maybe expanding. And then we put the children were about, age 3 and 4 years of age. And then we used a battery of tests. I suppose we had to have some measure of outcomes.
That's
so we tested them all on the same day. So we had two language scales.
Yeah.
We had an attention scale.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Winnie-Dunn sensory profiling because we needed to check their sensory regulation.
Exactly.
We had the Peabody motor development scale.
Right.
And then we brought in a cognitive scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the children were assessed all on the same day. So we had our speech and language therapist assessing the language scales.
That's right, Carmel Burke.
Yeah,
we had Pauline Moore, an occupational therapist.
Yeah.
And then you were doing the post assessment using the WebC.
And we were all blind to what group these children were going to fall
That's
into.
Right.
We had no idea.
That's right. And I didn't know either. I mean, I was involved in treatment only, so I wasn't involved in the assessment process at all. And so I came in and basically did the treatment.
You met them then, and then those families you began to treat on that day.
Exactly.
Yeah.
From that first day when you started to do the assessment, and then I had all the brown envelopes, and when I produced each envelope for each family, not knowing what was in it, and then it became obvious whether they were going to be part of the study in terms of were they going to be in the intervention group or were they going to be in the control group.
And then we, over the 6 months, and you're much better to explain this, you basically did your therapeutic listening with them.
So it was really interesting. Yeah. So basically what we did is we offered the intervention group the opportunity to meet with me on a regular basis. I started the listening program with them basically that day. We had the equipment and everything ready for them to get up and running. And so I developed the program based on what I saw with the child. So they got started more or less straight away. They were doing the therapeutic listening for approximately 20 to 30 minutes twice per day. It was dependent on the child, it was dependent on what was going on with them, but that was roughly kind of on average what we did. We did a whole variety of modified music from the therapeutic listening range of music, which would be Sheila Frick's range of music, and the whole therapeutic listening process has been developed by Sheila Frick. So basically I would meet with the family, we developed the program, they would run the program at home, the child would be doing the program for 5 out of 7 days per week, 5 days in a row, listening twice per day for usually, as I say, roughly 20 to 30 minutes. And then they had 2 days off. And so I met the family then once every, usually it was about on the 6 week mark, usually every 4 to 6 weeks. And I met them regularly over that 6 month period. And all the time, I was taking detailed information. I was getting the parents to fill out parent questionnaires.
Which
we'll go through at the end, which was very interesting. Some really lovely qualitative information mm-hmm. came up there, you know, in terms of the actual changes they were seeing in real life at home, which were so important. That the child was sleeping better, eating better, toileting was better, daily living activities, playing,
more animation,
more expressive, more words, more interaction, you know. So we'll go through, but there was lovely, lovely information that came from that. But again, it was a lovely opportunity for me to meet with the family and to develop the next step in the programme.
Yeah.
So that was basically what we did. And we went right through a series of, I think it was, the therapeutic listening chips, actually, we were using at the time, went right through a series of chips. So most children would have had an opportunity, I think, to do 4 to 5 pieces of music over that period,
which was really good.
Yeah. And generally they did each piece for roughly speaking, and it did vary a little bit depending on the needs of the child, because I did tailor make it for that, for each child, but roughly they were spending about 4 weeks on each piece of music.
Okay,
so that was really how it worked.
And
yeah. The
very interesting part of this as well is that all the parents were compliant, because that is something that could, you know, people will wonder about this research, is how compliant were the parents for carrying out this therapy the way we wanted them to do. And
absolutely.
I mean, I think you're a regular follow-up and contact with them, and that you're always there if they needed to contact you. But I think we're very confident that the parents were compliant, and
they were
actually quite happy to use the program, and the more they worked with it, the easier they fell into daily living.
Absolutely.
And so that worked really well, because that would be, you know, one question that people would ask, well, this is a home program, you know, does it work? But I think you can actually safely say that it does.
Absolutely. And it was great to, you know, finally have the opportunity to research that, because I see that every day in the clinic. And I think it really comes down to that the program is supervised by a clinician who understands the therapeutic listening, obviously really understands the child and works closely with the family. But at the end of the day, it's a home program.
And then we did very effective. At the end of a week course, we have to measure the outcomes of the children. So we...
We
administered the same group of tests again.
So we had our post-assessment, which was exactly the same test with the same clinicians. So it was yourself, Pauline and Carmen,
which
was fabulous.
Who had no idea which child was on
That's
the
right.
programme or not.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that, then our, I suppose... we have to look at the results and how the children did.
Absolutely. So of our 18 children, our 3 to 4 year olds, so and 9 in the experimental group,
That's
9
right,
in the control group, basically, what did we find?
Well, there were two key scales that stood out, the sensory processing scale and the attention scale. And there were changes in the other scales, but they were minimal, but there. And I suppose the ones that we can really emphasize are the sensory and the attention scales. And I suppose that makes it very interesting as well, because we see these as foundation scales for future learning.
Absolutely.
As you look at that pyramid of learning from Schellenberger.
Absolutely.
You have to have these skills in situ for the nervous system to develop, and then for them to move on in a nice chronological fashion through the different steps. And you know that better than I do.
God.
So the steps you're talking about are...
Oh, I mean, self-regulation is the key to really everything, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of child development. You know, even a little one that I had in today, and... he found it so hard to self-regulate, to stay calm. And the impact that it has, not only in terms of attention, focus, but in terms of comprehension, listening, speech,
processing,
interaction.
Yeah, you know, engagement.
If I'm so kind of up and down that I'm having meltdowns all over the place, or find it really hard to cope,
there's nothing going in. Yeah, you're constantly fighting your environment.
Yeah.
You're not allowing the information to, and it's as much visual, auditory.
Oh my God, it's right across. Balance that vestibular. We talk about that vestibular is such a critical piece, and that was one of the big ones that came up for us.
Yeah, I was so excited in one way about the attention scale, because I see this: if children aren't attending and registering and focusing on the stimuli that is coming at them from their environment around them, then they're not able to learn. And for our intervention group, quite interesting, 7 out of the 9 children showed improvement by 2 levels on the attention scale, which means they improved 2 years in terms of their maturity on the scale, because these children started out quite low in their attention levels.
Yes.
They improved, and for the other 2 children in the group, they improved by 1 year, by 1 level.
But I mean, that's huge,
man. It's huge over 6 months.
Over a 6 month period for children who are really struggling, really struggling in terms of regulation.
And these were down at 1 year attention level.
Yeah. And what we're saying is that self-regulation piece is laying the foundation for the development of attention. And for these kids who you described as busy, on the move, finding it hard to focus and attend, for us to say that over a 6 month period of therapeutic listening, because they really had no other intervention over that period.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, they were doing all the things they did
before. That's another important factor we forgot to say, actually. Yeah. No, and that's and then even the control group didn't have any intervention either. I mean, some children would be attending creche and that, but that would have been normal.
They were doing that pre-study as well.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, when you compare that to the control group, only 2 children in the control group improved by 2 years in terms of their attention level.
Okay.
5 improved by 1 level and 2 showed no change at all.
Okay. And I think something we have to say here is that what became very clear very quickly to me, because you know, from that first day and when I was giving out the envelopes, I could see the difference between the groups. There were actually 2 quite different groups.
I know, we were pretty unfortunate with the way the randomization worked out, because the group representing our intervention group were the, I suppose, weaker. I mean, this suddenly when they were grouped overall they were weaker.
Yeah.
They presented smaller. They they just had more needs, and our control group children were slightly more robust looking. Unfortunately, that's randomization.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think what's really positive about that is because we've proven, as you said, that the 2 scores, the 2 areas that are really jumping out where the kids have really made, you know, lovely changes, really nice improvements, are in terms of self-regulation for children who maybe struggled more with that. So, you know, and the attention end of things, coming up by 1 year and 2 years for kids who are really, were challenged
over,
with that.
Over 6 months. And it's amazing. And then that improved attention level linked in with their improved sensory profiling. And that would be in auditory processing, which is not surprising, because that's showing that because they were attending better, they were processing information better.
So start to filter that information, what you said earlier about those, the kids coming in, they're finding it hard to filter out that information. Yeah. So that means better comprehension. Better planning of language, better speech.
And then there were sensations seeking in the way that they were seeking information. They were responding to their parents.
Yes. So they were seeking the information. Sometimes when we say sensation seeking, you think it's a negative thing. But actually, in this instance, it was a really positive thing. They were seeking it, and they were not only, but processing it in a better way, which meant they could make sense of the world then.
And then their vestibular system improved immensely as well. That was around 67%. So that stood out well. And that, I suppose, in one way, again, it really makes sense, because your preterm child is usually the children we're dealing with, less than 1,500 grams. They're often, their last trimester is in the innate intensive care environment. That's the third trimester in pregnancy. And that is the the trimester with the most rapid brain growth, and that's when the brain starts to develop. So while we do a lot in the neonatal unit to compensate for the fact that they're now in an intensive care environment compared to maybe a child who's carried to term in a mum that's, you know, running around doing shopping, walking, climbing stairs, going
lots
to work.
Of vestibular,
so that child's getting lots of vestibular stimulation. Our preterm child is not receiving that. Plus, they're also guarding or defending themselves against the bright lights, the noise, the handling, inflammation, pain, all of these things, unfortunately, that are part of the preterm child's beginnings. And we have tried a lot to compensate for this. We do a lot of developmental supportive positioning, and we dampen down the noise in our units and we dampen down the lights. This is even more so why I'm so intrigued by the study and the sensory the sensory development, because I think that we have to support these children even at 2 years, even at 4 years, because they have had that type of beginning in their lives. And I think if we can do, when you always say, like, if the vestibular sense is rocky, it's like the tripod of the camera. That when their camera, it's, you know, they're, so the images that are going into their brain visually are blurred in, you know, what they're hearing is muffed, you know, like, and it's just the,
that vestibular sense. For me in clinic, even as a speech therapist, it might sound crazy to say, but I'm more interested in the vestibular sense than any other sense.
Interesting.
Because it tells me everything.
You think about that, that's the one that's most compromised for the children.
But
and
that's the biggest issue.
That's one of our biggest big improvements for the intervention group.
And that's, again, again, I think what's so telling about this research and why it's so important is because, you know, and it's something we kind of touched on briefly earlier, our study was very much about using therapeutic listening as a visible intervention with children born preterm. But what I see in clinic, because, yes, I see children born preterm, but I see children right across the, you know, children with all different challenges, some born full term, preterm, you know, with all different things going on, some with a diagnosis, some who don't have a diagnosis.
With children who are basically not driving and not, you know, kind of developing.
They're not reaching potential. Speech and language-wise for one reason or another. But the common thread is the vestibular sense.
It's very interesting.
Oh, my God. If I just, from my point of view, I feel if I'm not looking at that, I really don't understand what's happening with this child.
And it was very interesting what we haven't had an opportunity to describe in our research paper or on the poster, actually, is that what Pauline Moore, in our occupational therapist, observed when she was doing the Peabody motor scale, is that the children were expressing, I can't do it. They were feeling overwhelmed. They needed lots of requests to do an activity. They were compensating. They were avoiding. So therefore, the children themselves already knew within themselves that they were experiencing challenges, and they were helpless in being able to do this. So I think, again, if we can help them, then we can empower them. And I worry about children like that later on in the schoolyard, that they get isolated or they are not able to run around and kick a ball as much as the other children.
That's right. And how important that
And how important that is. And it's so important because it's social skill development. It, you know, it compromises a child. Maybe they become isolated or they maybe become a target for other children. You know, it's just... You know,
again, that's what's so positive here. We saw here with the results here that the vestibular processing, which is really what underpins sensory motor movement, you know, and that vestibular processing piece is critical. And we've proven that the therapeutic listening
see that with the children that have the attention deficits and, you know, their attention issues or challenges, that they're often very, that their movement isn't very modulated or coordinated. They're very heavy-footed. They're falling forward when they're walking and running. When you ask them to go down the steps, it's a completely precarious action. They look like they're going to fall, and yet they've got this, you know, sometimes they have little ways of checking themselves,
little strategies
that they're already using to help, but they're not enough.
Yes, and unfortunately those little strategies may get them through that movement at that time, but they're not really great strategies for life. And they're, I suppose what we're saying is that, you know, what Pauline Moran recognised and what she really saw in the pre and post test with this group was they really have movement needs and they have motor needs that need to be addressed by an occupational therapist.
Motor planning is the foundation for speech, for sequencing of, you know, for articulation, for answering questions, for sentence construction. Yes. And if you don't have that basic, and I think that's something I'm constantly telling parents each time they're in playground, movement, on even surfaces for walking on, little hills, downhills, just keep that movement going all the time, because it does impact. And so there is the vestibular sense again coming into play.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So that's really, really important. So the conclusion of the whole thing, Mary,
It was the first... Well, one primary conclusion, this is the first rollout of this type of intervention with a group of preterm children. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we need to, you know, particularly as nationally and internationally, there's a lot of talk about developing preterm baby pathways and like assessing these children at 2 years using a Bayley and again at five. Mm-hmm. I've got the NICE guidelines that are emphasising that. And they, but they are they haven't mentioned the sensory profiling, and I think that should become part of this as well. So now this is even more emphasised. Parents reporting of this experience was extremely positive.
Yeah. Yeah.
They found that it was really worked.
Mm-hmm.
It was a home programme. They found their children began to enjoy the music and were looking for it. So, and that's funnily enough, I had a little boy in the other day, and everything else he was ignoring. And when I played the little nursery rhyme for him to listen to, he stopped and he tuned in.
Yeah.
So it shows, you know, that this is a natural
need
in one way, if we were to look at it like that. And it does, when you mention it to parents, they say, oh, yeah, he loves music.
Absolutely. Yeah. Invariably, that's what parents say to me. You know, we feel this could be a good approach because we know he loves music.
Yeah.
But parents often say, but how are we going to get him to keep the headphones on?
I know,
on?
They ask.
You know, it's kind of like, and I know he likes music.
Car knows, yeah.
But, you know,
they will do.
Yeah, and as I said to parents, we have used this with thousands upon thousands of children.
That would be a
worry
question
for people.
But he won't be able, she's no way to work with it. I said, no, it will.
Do you know what?
Normal. Response.
Absolutely.
Because they're the type
is.
Of children we're talking about.
Absolutely. But there we have all the techniques, you know, and it's not just, you know, anyone doing therapeutic listening will have the techniques to guide parents through that. And because, you know, to my mind, over the last 20 years, I could count on two fingers the children we couldn't keep the headphones on.
That's not
forcing children, not at all. It's really about conditioning them, teaching them, you know, these two things go hand in hand. If you leave the headphones on, we're going to play with a lovely toy or whatever it is. So, and then kids just get used to it and they love it. And I, you know, so that's a really, I think, lovely thing for me. So that's a really important thing.
That's important. And then the other important piece of information is that if we can work on improving the attention levels of these children, then we're setting them up for, we're enabling them, we're empowering them for their future learning. And you're, you know, it's often I say to parents, it's what is very important for the here and now, it's actually when the children are 8 and 9 years of age, when they're in the classroom, because there is an image painted of the preterm infant in the classroom present, but that the information sort of just sort of gliding over their heads. So we want school to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
We want them to be part of their daily academic environment, because this is the way, this is the route all children have to take. It can't be avoided.
Yeah.
And if we can make that a lot easier, and so that homework and all these things don't become a struggle, and also just better outcomes in general. And like the long-term research is showing working memory as a problem, and executive functioning skills, which are the higher order cognitive skills needed for learning and for, you know, for school life.
Yes,
and if we can give the children better foundation in that regard, that would be that's what this is all about.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And the other thing, of course, is if we could have a meeting with early intervention centres around the country now so that this therapy becomes available to all children.
Absolutely.
Because at the moment it's only maybe if a parent is lucky enough to hear about you. And then, you know, this is something that, if we could, and it would be a service for all children, no, not absolutely. Just preterm children, and that's the other what children you're talking about. Yeah,
and that's what we said at the beginning of all of this, that really one of the main aims of the study was, of course, we wanted to see, you know, what are the results going to look like? What are we going to find and all of that?
Yeah.
But given the results that we have found, that it is a feasible approach to use with preterm infants to help them in terms of regulation, attention, focus, and ultimately, hopefully, language and learning, you know, it's not about people having to come to a private centre or someone working privately like me. We know, even in Ireland at the moment, and I know on an international level, there are a lot of therapists, whether it be psychologists, speech therapists, occupational therapists, trained in various forms of sound therapy. The one that we use this time, and I use a variety of forms, but this one is therapeutic listening. And we know even within Ireland at the moment, there's at least 100 therapists out there trained in this.
Yeah,
and that's across the public and the private sector. So I think, you know, there's a great opportunity here that, as you say, if we are talking or when we are talking to the various centres, that it's about us being aware of, okay, there are the therapists that are there, you know, who know how to use these approaches, know how to use these techniques. Let's look at developing, as you say, those care pathways for these children so that they really and truly are achieving their potential.
It's very cost effective as well because it's less therapist input. And the children are receiving the therapy every single day, whereas when they're visiting centres, it's just once per, you know, it's a session, one session per week if they're lucky enough, for 2 weeks, and sometimes once a month, and sometimes not at all. Even sometimes when parents say to me, "Oh yeah, they're attending OT," and I said, "How many times have they seen the occupational therapist?" Like, literally hardly any, maybe once. And I love this because it brings in an occupational therapy concept as well, because you're not just doing the headphones, but you're working on other areas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of it, isn't it?
It's bringing all of this together.
Yeah,
and I think these children need that occupational therapy concept as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
And it's
not... Yeah. And, of course, the great thing is you're not... how would I put it? You know, Sheila Frick, who developed therapeutic listening, is an occupational therapist.
Yeah.
But equally... she has trained speech and language therapists, psychologists, you know, people who are working with individuals from a whole neurological point of view in terms of the therapeutic listening, because she doesn't see it as something that's specific to OTs.
Yeah.
Yes, we're impacting on the vestibular sense. Now, you know, and the vestibular, often people think, well, the vestibular sense to movements, that must be just OT. Of course, equally it's physio, but equally it's all of us, because we're all, even for me as a speech and language therapist, you know, for me to say, of course, my main focus is speech and language development. But for me to say that my, when I see a child, what I'm most interested in seeing how it's functioning is the vestibular sense.
It's amazing,
Because that vestibular sense and the auditory sense are so inextricably linked. You know, we can't price them apart and say, okay, you're an OT, you're going to look at the vestibular. You're a speech therapist, you're just going to look at the auditory. And this is why multidisciplinary teams are so important.
It's sometimes I said that, and I'm not running the speech and language therapists that are out there. I'm not saying what they're doing. I think you always spoke about the missing piece of the jigsaw. So you can do a lot of speech and language therapy with the child and the parents. And sometimes I find this, parents are already very dedicated and they're doing a lot of work with their child, but the child isn't picking up on it and is not basically making progress.
No, absolutely.
And though that's where the listening comes into play.
Oh my God, And I mean, I'd have to say, and I, you know, I saw it again this morning. I had a lovely family in, and the terrible thing I think for me working with families, and I'm sure you see this as well, Mary, is that the families come in and they're so nervous. They're so nervous about what you're going to say, about what, you know, it's their child, and they've already probably been down the road and been told a whole variety of things, that there may be this going on, there may be this, you know, your child, you know. And then we start looking at all the pieces of the jigsaw. We start looking at the sensory, looking at the play, looking at the whole picture with the child. And then we start joining the dots and all of that. And invariably within all that, we gain a great understanding of the child and what's going on for them. And then we start talking about, how can we help your child come together better? How can we help them to be calmer, to listen better, to learn more
and
language?
And this impacts on family life at home, because a house can be very disturbed with a child. And you feel really sorry because parents can't go out for coffee. If they need something to go to the supermarket, they can't go because the poor child isn't able to deal with that big open space and the variety of stimulation. So, you know, that was where the parent questionnaires were interesting as well, because they were bringing in all of these daily functional changes. And this is where there was a research paper on the Winnie Dunn sensory profile, and they were comparing the validity of that test against another measurement. So there is a subjective measurement, but they were saying at the end of the day, the impact on the daily living skills or the family environment with these children is very, very important. And this is the change that our families were noting. And the children were calmer. They went, as we said earlier, they were went from busy kids to quieter kids. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of like really impressed with the whole, I suppose, if you, it's like nearly a flower just opening up. These children were just like opening, and they were opening the world around them. Absolutely. And they were beginning to engage, increase eye contact with parents. They were beginning to be more animated. The little kitty that wasn't getting up on the bike suddenly found his bike and said, I can do this, and the scooter. I mean, all these reports, it was amazing.
Absolutely.
Beginning to do Play-Doh, beginning to draw and scribble.
The improved eye contact, the better coordination, the balance, the social. I mean, it was right across the board. Yeah. But it comes back to that Schellenberger model again, you know, that hierarchy. You know, at the base of that, you've got the whole self-regulation. I need to be able to self-regulate. And I know that's a term we've used a lot here today, but it's about my neurological ability, my innate ability to calm myself, to regulate so that I process the sensory information from the environment and within easily.
And it's
easily.
Funny because I have the children who are incredibly calm and regulated, and they come in, and that's why I know there's a difference between the child who can't and the child who can. And recently seeing twins and trying to explain, first of all, I saw the first twin who had all our sensory dysregulation and explaining to mom the challenges that little boy was dealing with. And on this stage hadn't assessed his twin brother. And when his twin brother came in, he just showed the contrast was incredible. You know,
and when you see it there, like
so
that.
You know, then when you see it like that, then you know that that child is clearly struggling and clearly needs help. And even I suppose you often say, well, maybe will he sort this out himself? Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the way for him. I think he needs help to regulate and get that center system in synchrony with
himself.
And
because it comes back to that sensory integration piece, you know, really reinforcing that lovely foundation of being calm and regulated in my nervous system. And that lays the foundation for all the other skills.
It is the nervous system all over the place.
You
know, I mean, I even have found myself recently saying, what changes have you, like, what did you do to have your, you know, so your child is so regulated, engaging, communicating, eye contact, very focused and attentive to do the tasks, organized and methodical in their approach, enjoying the assessment, applauding their performances. And I'm going, so integrated, so regulated, so involved, and this child is just going to learn and learn and learn. Already this child is taking in so much information from the environment.
Absolutely.
In contrast to our poor kid who is not able to manage himself to pull together.
That's right.
And it's
And so that's the beauty of it, because sometimes what, you know, these really busy kids can look like they've so much going on, but actually it can be really quite simple. It can come down to, you know, because we can overcomplicate it, I think, sometimes. What I see in clinic is for the really busy kids and, you know, lots of other kids as well, how do we get regulated? How do we get regulated? And we've talked here today, I know, about very much about our research with the preterm infant. But I see it right across the board with all the kids that I see. And as I say, some have a diagnosis, some don't. It's just regulation is number one. I need to stay calm. Need to be able to calmly process, you know, sensory information.
It's, when you know you have something that will work for that child, because I worked years ago in a child guidance clinic, and I was dealing with older children mm-hmm. who were coming in with 2 to 3 year reading delays. Mm-hmm. Now that's because mm-hmm. there was a very long waiting list. Mm-hmm. And again, like mm-hmm. you look at this and you kind of go, it shouldn't be that long, but there were so many kids in need and there was no magic cure. And the problem, the common trait was attention and concentration. And I was just saying, is there any magic solution for concentration? And there isn't anything out there. And that was like, you know, how do I get my child to concentrate? How do I get my child to concentrate? So we're these are just general presentation of a group of children.
Yeah.
And if you had your listening therapy and you could apply it, you know, like that as a home treatment program, you would have those children clearing their, you know, the clinics who wouldn't be having these
long
waiting lists.
Absolutely, Mary. You know, so it's putting them in a very different situation. And that's the beauty of it. It's a non-invasive technique that can just really make a lovely
really
difference
work.
To kids.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's good because I think, we may need to, you know, have this be kind of rolled out with a larger population as well. But I think in the meantime, we can safely support our mm-hmm. findings and say that we should be even start, you know, that this is very, working out very well. And we know from the children that have come mm-hmm. to you from mm-hmm. me that they mm-hmm. are doing very well.
Absolutely. And just with that in mind, I had a lovely family in just the other day who came originally from you, and the mum. I just said to the mum, they've only been with me 3 months and I've seen them, I think yesterday was their third time maybe. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And they've been doing the therapeutic listening all the time and a little bit of brushing different things. And their little guy has just come on so much. And so I asked the mum, could I video her? So we'll add that on at the end just for people to get a little bit of a sense how a mum has experienced it and that kind of thing.
Be amazing. Yeah. Really, really good. Because I think it's very important to hear it from the mum's viewpoint because they're the ones that know and can see the difference.
Yeah.
Because I only have like 2 hours with these little ones.
Yes,
you know? It's amazing in that 2 hours. The moment they walk into the waiting room, to seeing how they play with the toys before assessment, and they give a lot of information in that few minutes. Mm-hmm, you know,
But it's the trained clinical eye as well. You're so used to looking at kids.
Yeah.
You know what to look for.
Yeah,
and you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always feel it's a partnership with the parents, that you're working in partnership
exactly,
with them.
Exactly.
They are the experts on their children.
Oh, gosh,
I mean, no one will ever know more than they know about their own children. And then I think the piece that we're adding in is our expertise from our own area.
And that's great about the baby scale, because you can bring the parents who are observing, and then I'll often comment and say, see how he had difficulty doing that. And it's, you know, and not to worry sometimes. You're just thinking, he hasn't done it now, but like, it's okay. I know what's happening here. We can fix this. You know, you're fine. You're fine.
Yeah,
you know, but,
I know.
Yeah, but
reassurance.
It's the reassurance. And, and, you know, often as much, you know, just acknowledging sometimes when you're in an assessment, you're nearly looking for the parts that aren't going as well for the child, but there's always strengths. All these children have amazing strengths, and when you see all that, you want to give them the opportunity
to reach their potential.
How long have you been using the therapeutic listening, Jean?
So we've been using the therapeutic listening with our son Tom since December, so that is 3 months now, and we just can't believe the difference in those 3 months. His engagement, his interaction, his regulation, it's all coming together, and it's been such a positive experience. We heard about this program through the psychologist in Hollis Street, and as soon as we called Karen, she was immediately there to help. There was no waiting lists, and it was just very seamless.
Brilliant. And what were your concerns, Jean? Why did you look at coming to me and look at doing therapeutic listening?
So our concerns were that our son was very busy. He was finding it very difficult to concentrate on tasks. His speech and language was delayed. He was born prematurely, so we obviously expected a lot of that. But traditional kind of routes so far hadn't achieved the results that we were hoping for. So the therapeutic listening has just brought everything together, and he's now a much happier, calmer child and much more engaged with us
as a little boy.
Fantastic. And at this stage, Jean, you're only 3 months into the music. I know we're going to do a little bit more, but what's your feeling now? You know, have you concerns? Are you, you know, what do you feel in general?
No, I feel we're on the right track because we've seen such results in such a short space of time. It's just really encouraging for the future. So I don't have the same anxiety or worry. I'm thinking about him going to preschool and I'm not really stressing out about it. I know he's going to be able to fit in with all the other children and keep up. And it's just alleviated so many concerns. So we know he's going to be much more ready for all of that, what's ahead of him.
Fantastic. And what would you say to any other parent, maybe of who is a child who maybe has been slow to get going in terms of speech or movement or sensory wise? What would you suggest?
I would definitely recommend the programme for therapeutic listening. It was something that I hadn't heard of before, and it's such an easy, simple thing to help your child do at home. And there is no big, I suppose, huge effort required, and that you don't need to be constantly there putting in loads of hours and worrying you're not doing enough. There's a pretty structured programme that you can stick to, and once you know you're doing it as you should be for the days, you're happy that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing for them.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jean. That's great, because we really want to share that with so many families who are in a similar situation and really aren't sure what exactly to do. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Karen O'Connor podcast. Please visit openingyourmind.com for more information on the work that I do. If you enjoy the podcast, please remember to subscribe to ensure that you don't miss out on future podcast episodes. And if you have a moment, please rate and review this podcast. The more ratings and reviews we get, the more people this podcast will reach. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye for now.